is that you can eat tons of it and never be satisfied. He said, recently I saw an apple, and for a moment I didn't recognize it. He said, what is that, an apple? It's just so weird to see it not in a pie. He said, they could find out that kale cures cancer, and I would still go with chemo. He also said, when I was dating my future wife, I once found myself comparing her to a bratwurst, and it was then that I realized I was serious about her. Well, we're going to look at food today in different ways and what Jesus has to say through that. And so look with me at Luke 5:33. They said to him, John's disciples often fast and pray, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking. Yours go on eating and drinking. They're bothered by this. You know, remember, Jesus has seen a few controversies lately as we've been going through Luke. First, how can you claim to forgive sins? Then, how can you hang out with sinners? And now, basically, how can you have so little fasting and so much feasting? For these guys, fasting was an inherent part of what it meant to be religious. Okay? I don't know what you think of when you think of what it means to be religious, but for these guys, they thought fasting, that's a big part of it. In fact, they fasted for the Day of Atonement. They fasted for 4 days to remember the destruction of Jerusalem. It wasn't uncommon for them to fast out of repentance or grief or various things. In fact, Pharisees fasted every Monday and Thursday to pray for the nation. It was a big part of what they thought religion was all about. And so they're baffled why Jesus' disciples did not do this very important thing. Now, it's interesting that not only the disciples of the Pharisees were involved here. Notice, also the disciples of John. In fact, Matthew's version of the story says that the disciples of John actually came to and asked Jesus, what's the deal? Apparently, this was deeply felt by a huge cross-section of the people that time. All your sort of, you know, godly, you know, mom, grandma types, whatever. They're all bothered by the fact that Jesus, he seems like a good boy, but why don't his people fast like everybody else? And so Jesus has a wonderful answer for them. Verse 34. Jesus answered, can you make the guests of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? Now this is deep. This is good stuff here. We're going to unpack this. You know, fasting, as I mentioned, it usually signified some kind of dissatisfaction with the present. Okay, if you're fasting, it means that you don't like something that's happening to you or that you've done, and you want God to intervene and help. And so you're trying to get his attention, okay? And so why would you be this sort of protesting at a wedding, right? I guess it would only be if you really, really didn't want to see them get married or something. Right? And in fact, weddings back then, they actually had a rule. They required 7 days of partying. You were not permitted to fast or engage in other acts of mourning or even difficult work during the wedding feast. Okay, 7 days of party. I could handle that kind of a rule. But you don't have protesters there, obviously. You don't invite your old girlfriend to the wedding so she can wear black and mourn and, you know, right? You don't. You invite your friends. They're going to party with you at the wedding. And so Jesus is saying, he's saying this. He's saying it's a time for rejoicing and feasting, not fasting. And notice why. Because in verse 34, the bridegroom is with them. Now this probably has double meaning. The Old Testament repeatedly compares the Lord to the groom or the husband of his people. In Hosea 2, God talks about winning the love of his bride, Israel, speaking tenderly to her, wooing her so she would give herself to him and be his wife forever. In Ezekiel 16, God says that he found Israel when she was homeless and abused and messed up. And then he marries her and he cleans her wounds and he clothes her with an embroidered dress and fine linen and costly garments and leather sandals and gold and silver jewelry, and bracelets and necklaces and earrings and beautiful crown and good food. All this is in Ezekiel 16. And then in Isaiah 54, he says, for your maker is your husband. The Lord Almighty is his name. Later in Isaiah, No longer will they call you desolate. Your new name will be God's delight and the bride of God. For the Lord delights in you and will claim you as his own. See this? All this Old Testament imagery about God being the husband. And so it could all be summarized as God is the true husband, our true husband, and he's coming for us. That could be sort of a summary of that theme of the Old Testament. And so, it's this idea that he loves you far more than any other human being. The only person who could ever be as faithful to you is God. You're never going to satisfy the hole in your heart through anybody other than God. It's him. And he's coming to save you. And so here, Jesus very well may be alluding to this and saying, guess what, guys? Your bridegroom is here. In fact, the Greek is phrased in such a way that there is an understood no in the question. Can you make the guests of the bridegroom fast while he's with them? No! Of course not. The groom is finally here. It's party time. You know how long we've been waiting for this? Millennia. For God to come down and show up and be the Messiah for us. It's like ever since we told my daughter Marion that we're going to throw a birthday party for her, it seems like just about every other day she's asking me, is today the day for my birthday party? You know, no, it's in a month from now. Okay, why did we tell her that it's coming? You know, no. But it'd be like a month from now, you know, Marion, it's your birthday. We're having the party today, but we've decided the whole family is going on a vegetarian diet. Right? Jesus says, this doesn't make sense. Him arriving on the scene is the greatest event in history. Strike up the band, rent the bounce houses and the horses and the elephants and get out the steaks and cook the pies. This is it. It's not time for a vegetarian diet. And now don't miss this. I'm not just giving rhetoric up here. Honestly. Jesus is saying that his presence brings incredible joy. That's what he's saying. In his book, Surprised by Joy, C.S. Lewis describes himself as the most reluctant convert in all of England. He said he was dragged into the kingdom by his heels, kicking and screaming. But he likened it to this. He likened it to bracing yourself to dive into a cold mountain stream and then finding it delightful. That as we experience Jesus, you know, we may never have guessed that it'd be delightful, but it is. It's joy. He brings joy. And so develop your understanding of him. If this seems completely foreign and you're looking at me like this, you're nuts. Honestly, I found it to be true. Pursue him. Develop your understanding of him, your relationship with him, your worship of him, your service of him. He's where it's at. And then look with me at verse 35. But the time will come, Jesus says, when the bridegroom will be taken from them. In those days, they will fast. Here Jesus alludes to his death. It's troubling how he states it. He says the bridegroom will be taken from him. It's almost like that the groom will be removed in his wedding celebration. Reminds me of the story from December of Riley Knight from Crown Point, Indiana, who after his wedding reception, he and his wife Nikki were driving back to their hotel almost midnight, and they saw a woman who had slid off the road in the snow near Crown Point. He said, "We got to stop. It's late, and they need help." He pulled his truck into a nearby driveway, and his wife waited inside while he went out to help this woman. But while he was standing by the side of the road trying to help her, he was struck and killed by a passing vehicle. This is the kind of sadness that Jesus is comparing the Christian life to, in a sense. Even though the marriage is just happening, it's like the groom has finally come and he is the party is starting, but guess what? It's going to be grievously cut short. He's going to have to go back to the Father in the middle of it, and in those days his bride will fast. Here's an image we don't often think of the church as: a young widow. But in so many ways it's true. God's people had barely started to experience this joy of Jesus, and then he's whisked away from it, and now they grieve. Now we grieve. I know some of you have lost spouses, and I'm And I hesitated to even go here today because I know this is tough. I can't even imagine your pain. But in some days, in some ways, you know, Jesus, it's just, this is what Jesus is saying. That in one sense, we are feasting because we've started to experience Jesus. But in another sense, we're starving because we don't get to experience the fullness of his presence yet. And I don't want to minimize either side here. There's a tension. On one hand, the scripture says, taste and see that the Lord is good, that Jesus is the bread of life and the living water, and that knowing him and trusting him and experiencing him is the best thing that you will ever experience in this life. Satisfying. It's hope. He's better than honey, Proverbs said, his wisdom is. He's the feast. Okay, it's absolutely true on one side. But on the other hand, Romans 8 reminds us that all creation is groaning and in the chains of bondage to decay. Repeatedly, the Christian life is compared to this long, hard wait, like running a marathon, seemingly forever. The denial of your cravings, the challenge of enduring messed up people and messed up world, and the sacrificing of your life and your money and sometimes overwhelming demands of this life. In one sense, the Christian life is certainly a fast. If you're going through tremendous stress and pain, let this passage be a comfort to you that Jesus knows. He predicted. He knows what you're going through. He knows the depth of the famine you are feeling. And like those Old Testament people did with the fasting and the weeping and the ripping of your clothes, God invites you to cry out to him and beg him for change. He can handle your explosive expressions. He can handle your honesty, your prayer. Don't hold it into him. Pray and fast and weep and bring your needs to Jesus because he cares about you. There's something right about fasting in our age. Something right about recognizing how messed up the world is and about sort of protesting it or just begging God to intervene through fasting and prayer. There's something right about that. But you know, Jesus doesn't command it here. Notice. He doesn't respond to them and say, oh, you're right, we should be fasting more. I think I'll command everyone to do that all the time. He doesn't make it a test of spirituality. But it can be helpful. Jesus allows it. He said, they will fast when I go away, because it's going to be hard. And it can be helpful to fast, and if it's done quietly and humbly, as a way to pray, as a way to recognize our dependence on God, as a way to beg him for the things that really matter. You might want to try it if there's something really bothering you, huge thing in your life, to bring that thing to the Lord in that way. But on the other hand, if your Christian life only feels like a fast, then you've missed something. You've missed something. If you're finding yourself regularly depressed or frustrated, and this is sort of your way of life, then you've missed the fact that Jesus is the feast. He's the long-awaited groom. He is joy. And so pursue him and allow him to form that in your heart as you pursue him. All right, that's our first section today, the fast or the feast. We're going to look at a second section here, the new or the old. The new or the old. Look with me at verse 36. He told them this parable. No one tears a patch from a new garment and sews it on an old one. If he does, he will have torn the new garment. And the patch from the new will not match the old. All right, so my wife likes to buy me new clothes. And She bought me these new pants, which I'm still not sure I like them, these purple pants. They still got the tags on them. They're good clothes. Good thing. And then I have this other pair of pants that's been around a while, all right? That me and him go way back. I like this pair of pants right here, okay? But the problem is that pretty soon they're going to be shorts. And so I need to fix them. And so I had this idea. My wife has this new pair of pants for me. And I was thinking maybe I could just cut off a piece and sew it to this hole and patch this one up. What do you guys think about that idea? even if you told me to do it, I value my marriage too much to do that. Of course not. Why wouldn't I do that? Well, because it's destructive and it's a waste, right? Why would I waste this new pair of pants, even if they are purple, on fixing these jeans, right? It would be worse for everybody. Okay, it wouldn't match. That's Jesus' example. Okay, and then he goes on to a similar example. Look with me at verse 37. He says, "And no one pours new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the new wine will burst the skins, and the wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, new wine must be poured into new wineskins." Okay, so they take the skin of goat or whatever, and they would wrap it up, and they would sew it together, and they would make these skins for wine, right? And they'd fill it with wine. And so it'd be like a leather flask. But over time, this flask would get brittle. And now, some of you guys know what happens to wine, right? Over time, it ferments, right? And it gives off gas. And so what happens when you put a new wine in this old brittle leather pouch and you seal it off? And as it ferments, guess what? It's not going to be able to contain it. And so it breaks and it brittly destructs as the gas pushes on it, right? And so Jesus is saying this. He's saying, should I pour this wonderful new wine into this old leather flask? And just like you guys said earlier, you know, or thought at least, no, don't do that. Don't do it. It would be a waste. It would break and the good wine would be lost. Don't pour that wine on the floor. Don't cut those new pants. Don't waste it. What's Jesus saying? This is what he's saying. Most commentators think he's claiming to bring a new and better way, and it can't be contained in the old way. It's new. It's like the new pants or the new wine. It's better than the old law. It's better than all that stuff about fasting and sacrifices and all this old stuff that they've had to do for thousands of years. He says his way is going to be new and it's going to be better. And those Jews, they're a lot like us. They hated to waste anything. I'm always amazed at Berlin big trash week. You know, other people running around in trucks filling them up with. I'm like, why are they taking that off of that guy's lawn? Like, that needs to go to the dump. But no, we can't waste anything in this town, right? And Jesus knew that about the Jews too. He's saying, you don't want to waste a piece of good clothing or good wine, then don't waste this opportunity of experiencing the newness that I came to bring. It would be a way greater waste. You get it? Don't miss out. There's a massive newness to what Jesus was doing, and it went far beyond the issue of fasting. He was literally making everything new. Everything. He's making the way of salvation new. No longer people have to kill animals to be saved. Jesus would take that punishment that they deserve for their sin, and he would die once and for all. He was making the contract between him and his people new. No longer was it a contract or a covenant of works. Obey and be blessed, disobey and be cursed. No, now it's this contract where Jesus did it all. And we receive him and we receive all those blessings. He's making his people new. He was literally coming to live inside them and change their desires and their actions and to be good and godly. He's making their relationship with him new. The prophets talked about how everyone from the youngest to the oldest would come to know Jesus. And to know God deeply and really know him for themselves. And he was making creation new. Romans 8 says that Jesus will literally set free the created universe from its bondage to decay. And that through him, all of creation would be recreated someday. You see, these guys who come up to Jesus, it's like their vision was way too small. It's like, Jesus, you know, God has been laying on our hearts the need to confront you because your people don't fast like we think they should. And Jesus is like, come on. You gotta be kidding me. You guys are worried about fasting when I'm doing something way bigger. I'm going to make everything new. It's not going to fit in your little old forms and your old ways of doing things. It's going to explode out of it to the whole world. Jesus is saying he's not just a patch on your old clothes of your life. He doesn't want to be a patch to your messed up life. He wants to be the new thing. He wants to be the transforming, the revolutionizing, the completely redefine your life thing. So don't treat him like a patch. That's one part of this passage. Treat him like the new clothes. Treat him like the new wine. Isn't it interesting that he uses this metaphor of wine? Okay? Don't get too uncomfortable like this, you know, about this, but if you're think about it. What does wine do? It makes people happy. That's one thing it does. Another thing it does is it makes the person drinking it do things they wouldn't normally do. It often controls them. Remember on Pentecost, what the people thought the disciples were, remember? They thought they were drunk. When the disciples were talking about Jesus and explaining this way of salvation, they're like, holy cow, how long have these guys been drinking? They're doing something way out of the ordinary. It's controlling, whatever they got in them is controlling them. It's making them happy. They must be drunk. Jesus is the new wine. He's tasty. He brings joy. He changes us. He controls us. I found this, some amateur poet on the internet wrote this little poem, and it's kind of lame, but I thought it's actually kind of cool too, and so I just want to read it. It says, new wine, the kind that makes you smile all the time. I heard about it just a little while ago, and ever since I did, I just can't let this happy feeling go. Pardon my funny grin, I'm just a new wineskin holding new wine. Now the poet, he sounds kind of goofy or drunk maybe, but honestly I resonate with his poem. There's this simple, amazing joy in following Jesus. And it's a whole lot like new wine. Now look with me at our last verse of our passage, verse 39. And no one, Jesus said, after drinking old wine, wants the new. For he says, the old is better. Jesus is confronting this person, them, as not even trying the new wine. Notice it says, no one after drinking the old wine wants the new, for he says the old is better. They know what they like, Jesus. They know the old is always better. You know, they ordered off the same thing off the menu for 50 years. There's no need for the new. You know, they're a lot like we are today in Berlin, Wisconsin, or Ripon, Wisconsin, in this area. There's a whole lot of people are saying, you know, things have been the same for hundreds of years, and we're not about to change now. Right? We've got it figured out. We got life figured out. What is that newfangled church in town? Somebody getting all emotional over my dead body. My daddy and his daddy and his daddy, we all didn't care about Jesus, and I'm not about to start now. Right? This is the kind of attitude. I'm poking fun, but honestly, change is difficult for all of us, isn't it? I got this, there's a study that has been done on change. I got a bell curve picture here for you to show that Everett Rogers has studied people's reactions to change. And what he's found is that within the general population, the following responses to change are predictable. 3% are innovators of change. 13% are early adapters to change. 34% are cautious of change. Another 34% are skeptical of change. 16% will outright resist change. And then the lowest part of that, you will like die over any change, right? This is typical. Where are you? My guess is that the vast majority of you guys are right there in the middle, cautious and skeptical of change. I am. That's how most of us are. And yet Jesus here, he's reminding us that when he brings newness, it also affects the forms of worship. That the most important thing is the wine that he's bringing, that the newness of who he is and what he's doing, but the wineskin can change. Not only did it change back then, changing from the Old Testament forms to the New Testament forms of worship, but worship forms continue to change. They will continue to change until we're all dead, and they will continue to change beyond that. Language isn't static. Styles of music and dress aren't static. This passage reminds us to be open to the new places and styles and ways that God will work. Chuck Swindoll tells the story of a friend of his who took a position as a youth pastor at a church. This way back in the day, this would have been like in the 70s or 60s, maybe something like this. And he decided to show his youth group a missionary movie. It was a black and white film that was about a missionary. Okay, and afterwards, a group of leaders found him an hour after he did it, and they called him in and they asked him what he had done. Did you show the young people a film? In all honesty, he responded, well, yeah, I did. We don't like that, they replied. Well, without trying to be argumentative, the youth worker reasoned, well, I remember that at the last missionary conference, our church showed slides. And one of the church officers put his hand up, signaling him to cease talking. And then in these words, he emphatically explained the conflict. If it's a still, fine. If it moves, sin. You can show slides, but as soon as they start moving, you're getting into sin. Okay? Earl Hardy says this. He said, throughout my 30 years of ministry, I have encountered hundreds of Christians who are like old wineskins. Whenever any new idea or concept is introduced, they don't like it. It may be a new building program, new schedule, new budget, new program, new method, you name it. You can almost hear them straining and cracking until, pop, they blow a stitch and express their anger and opposition. Why? Because they have become inflexible like old wineskins. Someone has said that the seven last words of any church are, we've never done it that way before. And so let's not get too attached to any one cultural expression. Let's be willing to change our wineskins if we need to in order to help people experience the new wine. That's why I'm so excited that Aaron, you know, youth group, and they got all the, you know, the hats and the stuff and the skateboards and whatever, you know. It's awesome that he's speaking their language and doing their thing, you know, helping them get Jesus, understand him. Once on a world tour, Rudyard Kipling saw General Booth come aboard the ship, the founder of the Salvation Army, and he came aboard to the beating of tambourines, which Kipling resented because of his strict Christian traditions. Kipling told the general how much he disliked tambourines, and Booth looked at him and said, young man, if I thought I could win one more soul for Christ by standing on my head and beating a tambourine with my feet, I would learn how to do it. Fosdick has said this. He said, Galileo was branded a heretic when he held that the earth moved around the sun. Lister had to fight for antiseptic technique in surgeries. Let us take care when we resent new ideas that we are not simply demonstrating that our minds have grown old and inelastic. We should never be afraid of new methods. That a thing has always been done may very well be the best reason for stopping doing it. That a thing has never been done may very well be the best reason for trying it. Any business which had lost as many customers as the church would have tried new ways long ago, but the church tends to resent all that is new. Now let me be clear here. In order for us to be faithful to the Lord, we will repeatedly have to change our ministries, our styles, on and on. Okay? Wineskins will wear out and we'll need to try something new. But what must never ever, ever change is the new wine. It's Jesus and his transformation and his word and who he is and what he came to do. That can never change for us to be faithful to him. We desperately need him as the center of who we are and what we're doing. This passage makes him central, right? Central. He's the groom. He's the brand new wardrobe. He's the new wine. It's about Jesus being the most important center of our lives. That's what he wants. Let me close with this illustration. One commentator said this. He said, when the children of Israel were faced with the new idea of going into the promised land, they in effect said, no, we like the old wine better. And God said, okay, fine. Then you're going to take another lap around that desert and another. And for 40 years, they wandered in the old paths, eating the same old junk. And why? Because they refused to accept the new wine of God's plan. And so let me ask you this morning. God is calling each one of us into the lush new land of what it means to experience Jesus as center of our lives. Don't turn him down just because it seems too crazy or strange or you've never done it that way before. How foolish to just stay with the old because it's familiar and waste the opportunity to experience the fullness of what God has for us. So recognize Jesus for who he is. Ask him to come in and fill your life like pouring new wine into you and emptying your old stuff, your old sin, and receiving his forgiveness and his life-changing presence. And then live your life with him as the center rather than you. It's that simple. How foolish to cut up a nice pair of pants or to allow his new wine to be poured on the ground. Or to let his mouth-watering feast go moldy. And as far as the feast goes, we can start that feast right now in Jesus. But it's just a piece of it, right? It's just like a glimmer or a taste. It's like seeing through a glass darkly. And some days it feels more like a fast. And maybe right now you're in that fast. Your life is hard and you're crying out to God. Don't give up. Keep waiting and praying and persevering and elevating Jesus to his rightful place in your life. Let's keep looking forward to the feast that's to come when he will make everything new. Revelation says that the time will come when we will say, "Let us rejoice and be glad and give him glory, for the wedding of the Lamb has come and his bride has made herself ready." And then God will live with us and he will wipe away every tear from our eyes, and there will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old has passed away and the new has come. Let's pray.